From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome. Welcome to Wharton Moneyball here on SiriusXM, the podcast version. This is Eric Bradlow, Professor of Marketing and Statistics here at the Wharton School. I'm joined by my longtime friends and co-hosts, Professor of Statistics and Data Science Adi Weiner, Professor of Statistics and Data Science Shane Jensen, some combination of the three of us, and Cade Massey are here every week on Wharton Moneyball. So guys, how are you doing today?
Doing very well. How are you doing?
Well, I'm very proud of Grandpa Adi. Congratulations, yeah. Grandpa. It's exciting news. You beat me to it. Where Adi and I, for those people that don't know, Adi, Cade, and I were all born in the year, the magical year of 1967. And Adi's made it to being a grandfather. So Adi, mazel tov, as we say.
Thank you. It's a great feeling. I'm only 56 years old, but it's a great time to get started to being a grandpa. Or I'm going to call it Saba in Hebrew.
Ah, Saba. Yep. Yep. Well, in my family, it was Zeta. But either way, congratulations, Adi. So guys, in the second half of our show, we're going to have Neil Payne on, senior editor and writer for The Messenger. I know we're going to talk to him a lot about college football, which is obviously a big thing. Obviously, the NBA is going on. Since he specializes in those, we're going to talk about that. So I thought in the first half of our show, we'd move in a different direction since we'll probably talk to Neil about those topics. The first one, I noticed something in hockey, and I want your guys' prediction based on what's happened. So currently, there are three teams, the Bruins, the Rangers, and the Golden Knights, who have all played 24 games. So that's 30% of the season. Hockey season, I think it's 80 games or 82. I forget which.
82.
All right. So actually, I did an underestimate. You'll see. Each of them has 37 points right now, which translates to a season total. I forgot those two extra games. It actually translates to a season total of about 125, 126. Now, there have only been six teams in the history of hockey that have scored more than 125 or more points in the history in a season. But we have three of them now that are on track. So if you had to try to forecast, that's why you'll see, Adi, this isn't a hockey question. What's the distribution of the maximum for this season, given we have three teams on pace for 125? Because normally if it was one team, you'd say, well, I'm going to shrink backwards. You know, maybe they would have averaged 1.3 points a game, which is like 100 to 105. There's a third way in. I'll shrink 125 back to like 116. But now I've got three teams. I've got three teams that are actually on a pace for 125 plus. So I'm sure our listeners would love to think about, like, how would you think about trying to forecast the maximum? Adi, I'll start with you, and then that'll give Shane and I a chance to say, what the hell would we do here?
So it's actually interesting, because what I will do is very different, I imagine, than someone who knows more about these teams, right? So it's interesting, because when you talk about shrinkage, you should be shrinking back to like preseason estimates in some level, and rather than like the overall mean, Rangers? Really? So I'm going to think, I don't know that much about these teams. Golden Knights, right? Okay, Bruins, really good team. So maybe my initial guess would be something like 50% probability that one of them hits it. And then essentially the rest of the probability on almost the rest of it on none, with maybe a little bit on two. I mean, really a small amount on two.
So Shane, do you agree that if I gave you even money right now, which is if any one or more, of course, of the teams hit 125 plus, you win the bet and I'll take the under. You take that bet?
I would probably take that bet, even though in my gut, my viscera says regress all the stuff really hard. I mean, towards the mean, I think. And I mean, I agree with Adi. You know, the knowledge perspective we can have is that the Bruins did this last season. So, yeah.
That's a good start.
Right.
We can regress them back. They got 135 last season. I can regress them back and they get to 125 easy, right?
Yeah. No, and I do think it is kind of unique. I think it's not unlike, was it this season? Two seasons ago, I can't remember baseball where we were sitting on three or four teams with like plus 100 win kind of probably, paces sitting here in like June or something like that. And we regressed them pretty hard. And I think in that season, it only ended up being like two out of the four or something like that. But that's still,
Well, let me ask you guys a statistical question, because you just brought out something really interesting, Shane. I'm going to make a statement, and you said the way you agree or not. I hadn't even noticed when I posted this in our rundown that the Bruins last year were one of those teams. Do you both agree that's more information to make this prediction than the historical distribution of the number of teams that have made this? In other words, let's imagine I ask you, Adi, make this prediction of the probability at least one of them. And I'm going to give you two pieces of information. One is one of these three teams had 135 last year. The other piece of information is it's only been done six times in the history of hockey. Which piece of information changes your probability more?
Six times in the history of hockey. That's the biggest one.
Really? I would have thought. All right, you disagree with me. I would have answered the other, which is one of these three teams had 10 more points than this last year. Shane, I'd love your thought.
I think, again, my viscera says I'm with Audie. I think, the fact that this is sort of against such strong historical standards gives one pause for any kind of prediction of extreme behavior. But the Bruins obviously are kind of, I mean, are a weird exception to most historical rules and have been now for a couple seasons. So yeah, I mean, I'm kind of intrigued whether we're sort of seeing, whether this is actually evidence of some kind of increasing almost sort of disparity in hockey, where we've got these kind of
Well,
really,
good point. The
are we
Lightning, by the way,
approaching
we
more
have
of a
two of the
base?
top, we have two of the top five in the last 4 years.
Yeah, is hockey maybe moving more towards the kind of basketball thing where you have these dominant super teams and then, there's a lot of very bad teams. As a fan of one of those bad teams, the Calgary Flames, I've thought about this a lot. But I don't know. We certainly don't have evidence for that. And certainly if it's just the Bruins standing there at the end, we'll probably just be like, well, they're a historically great team that's managed to keep it going. And hopefully won't get knocked out in the first round of the playoffs,
Yeah, exactly.
as often happens in hockey.
Well, guys, it's always fun to talk about hockey, but I thought this was just a more general point about the distribution of the maximum when you have multiple shots at it. It's not just one team going for it in this case, at least it's three teams. And I think we've all agreed that we're going to do some shrinkage, but 30% of a hockey season isn't zero. It's not five games, it is 20 something games. So, I mean, yeah, go ahead, Adi.
I just think, I mean, it's interesting because I gave 50% at least one, but I would probably put most of that probability on the Bruins.
I think that
So
makes a lot of
the
sense.
other two are just gravy there, right?
All right. Well, guys, since it's the three of us, we get to talk about our most favorite topic. And since, I go to Cooperstown every year, it might be my most favorite topic. And since I'm a baseball historian, the Hall of Fame. So, first of all, their Hall of Fame ballots are out. Adi mentioned that, I think, last week on the show. We actually only have nine ballots back, at least as of 2 hours ago when I looked. Is there any. I know it's time. No, so Shane's saying no. Is there any information at all in nine ballots? Can you learn anything whatsoever in nine
Yes.
ballots? Okay,
Yes. I
go
mean,
ahead,
yes.
Adi.
Yeah. I mean, if I came from Mars, I know that Adrian Belcher is going to make it because he's on all of them,
But
right?
is there was there information in that nine ballot? Like, we knew that before those nine
Yeah,
ballots
yeah,
came
yeah,
in.
yeah. So that so so to be quite honest, and anything that we didn't, is there any information in the nine that we already didn't know? Probably not really. I mean, I think Helton's going to be on the border. And the nine doesn't clear that up. Mauer's going to be on the border. Wagner's going to be on the border. We don't know enough about that. So the bottom line is, I mean, I guess we're learning maybe a little bit about the ones who are outside. I don't think Chase Utley is going to make it, but he's running about five of them. What is it? Five of the right?
Five
But
of the nine, yeah.
I mean, I mean, so he's certainly not. I would guess, by the way, he's not going to be 20%, even though it's only five, right? I mean, I always thought when I teach my statistics, square root law means you get very little extra information when you get more observations when you already have 100. But the other side of the square root law means when you go from two to six, you get a lot.
But also, sorry, go ahead, Shane.
I just a question mostly for Audie, because I think you're the one most closely tracking this over time.
Yeah.
How, what for somebody like me who wants to see Chase Utley in the Hall of Fame, but I knows I'm not going to see him first ballot, what percentage in the first year is kind of what percentage is in the first year is predictive of eventually making
I got a number. I got to know. I say 40%, but I'd interested in Nadi's number.
Yeah, so I was going to say 40%. It depends on what's in who's in this year. So this year has a lot of has other than Beltre, he's the new guy who's the shoe-in, mm-hmm. right? Some year you can get like three, right? And some year you can get nothing.
Yeah.
So it depends on what's happening. So 40
and presumably good, what's going to be happening over the
right,
next
so
few
40
years
is a
as
good
well.
Floor. If you're not hitting 40, you're probably not going to make it. But some years, 50 is what you can expect because there's no competition, right? Because you only get 10 and et cetera, et cetera. So I think this year has a lot of what I call bubble candidates, like more than a large. I think you got Andrew Jones is a bubble, Wagner, Maurer, Helton. These are your bubble guys who are all competing to get over that threshold. And I don't think we're going to see them all. So that's going to leave a little less space for the new guys like Utley to, because everybody knows we can just hold off on giving space to him. And these guys are going to grow. So although I will say, seeing Utley at 40, and he's now at 55, it doesn't mean anything. He's only 9 or I think there's 11 ballots. Bottom line is that
oh, yeah, 11,
I'm an Utley supporter. I'm kind of decently pleased with what the earliest returns.
Or, I think you have – I just want to interject one thing. You have learned one thing. It's not a lot, but it's one thing. We can all agree with this mathematically. Adi's right. It's 9 public ballots to announce. It's 11 ballots in. Well, 75%, right, of 11 is 8.25, okay? So Adrian Beltre has 11. He's plus 3.75 right now. Helton has 10 out of 11. He's plus 1.25. So that's the way I always view it. I'm not saying it's a lot, Shane. I'm saying it's tiny. But he has 1.25, Helton's got 1.25 extra votes to spare now, which means for the remaining whatever 400-plus ballots or 300 and something, it's not a ton, but that's the way I'm going to be tracking it. How many excess ballots above 75% does the person have as we're sitting here? And what's the implied percentage they need? And let's say, and Adi did this last year, let's say he's tracking at 80% with half the ballots in. Well, then do we believe he's going to be below 70% for the other half of the ballots in? Because that's what you'd have to believe. And so that's where we are. But Shane, I know you can jump in.
I think Helton's been trending towards the threshold every year, moving up. And so
he was 72 last year.
Yeah,
right?
No, and I mean, that's actually kind of be what I wanted to kind of just interject about the trend in the sense that, like, you kind of put, like, you know, Andrew Jones and Joe Maurer, like, Joe Maurer and Andrew Jones are two different types of bubble candidate. I mean, bubble candidates, and that, like, Andrew Jones, they're at this a similar number of, you know, maybe at a similar vote, but this is Maurer's first year. Mm-hmm. And it's Andrew Jones's six. So, you know, I mean, I think you, in the sense that, you know, probably players are only going to trend up if they're
Maurer's
over that kind of
it.
Threshold.
So by the way, I think that we're seeing is Maurer. Maurer's a guy who had 7 amazing years as catcher, and the rest of his career was pretty mediocre as first base. So you're looking at a guy and going, and you're trying to gauge the voters and saying, catcher is such a difficult position that when someone can hit as well as he did at that position for at least a half a career's worth, if you will.
At least half a career.
Yeah, no, I think it's almost – yeah. I can't claim to know what the baseball writers are thinking, but if they don't let Joe Maurer – if Joe Maurer doesn't get in, what catcher ever is going to get in
right.
again,
I mean,
basically?
Like, forget it, right.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and Andrew Jones is interesting because this is a guy who played forever. He came up at like 19 or something. And it's kind of a vote for defense.
Yeah.
Yeah, he hit 50 home runs one year, but his career totals as an offensive production are not necessarily Hall of Fame standard as an outfielder. But
yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting. I was kind of comparing him and Jim Edmonds, both center right. fielders.
Right.
Basically, the almost identical total war, but Jim, obviously, Edmonds is known mostly for his offense, and somehow that was not enough to get him to the Hall of Fame. Andrew Jones, bubble candidate, known mostly for his defense.
So guys, we only have 1 minute left. So I'm just going to ask you yes, no, to make predictions on the following people. I'm going to assume we're all going to say yes on Beltre and Helton. So I'm not going to bother with them. Yes, no, we have 1 minute.
This year or?
Yeah, this year. Gary Sheffield. No, eventually. Eventually. Oh. Is Gary Sheffield going to make the Hall of Fame?
No.
I'm going to go with no also.
I'd say no. Joe Maurer.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Billy Wagner.
Personally, no, but yes.
I think he will, but I agree with Adi. He should not.
I don't even. Alex Rodriguez.
No, but yes. He won't make it, but he should.
Yes, I'm with audio on that one as well.
Andrew Jones.
No and no.
I think no. Too,
Chase Utley.
Yes and yes.
Yes and yes.
Same. I assume that we all think the same. If A-Rod's in the Hall of Fame, Manny Ramirez should be in the Hall of Fame.
Well, he's good, but he's not going to get in.
He's not getting in.
No and yes.
And Ramirez is different. I mean, we could argue. We could give a whole damn half a show to this.
Right.
We should probably do that. You know, talking about Manny.
Yeah, and I mean, the steroid guys obviously are a whole different category, really.
All right, guys. Well, that's been the first half of Wharton Moneyball. All our listeners, stay with us and join us for Neil Payne from The Messenger for the second half. Please stay with us and join us right after the break.
You're listening to Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome. Welcome back to the second half of Wharton Moneyball, my favorite show, my favorite time of the week where sports statistics and business collide. Again, this is Eric Bradlow, professor of marketing and statistics. I'm acting as the primary host today, with our colleague and collaborator, Cade Massey, being away. I'm here joined by my co-host, longtime friend, graduate school classmate. Well, we sort of overlapped, didn't overlap, but either way, same department, Shane Jensen. And of course, Shane, one of the great parts of Wharton Moneyball is that we get to have guests on the show. Although I think it's almost unethical to call this person that we're joining us today a guest, since he's almost been on as much as all of us.
He's like the Steve Martin of Wharton Moneyball or something like that.
That's a very good analogy. But here we are joined by Neil Payne. Neil's a longtime friend of the show, senior editor and writer for The Messenger. People know his work all over the place. 538, used to work for Atlanta Hawks. Neil, welcome back to Wharton Moneyball.
Welcome, guys. You know, I have my banjo right here, so the Steve Martin comparison is apt, I think.
Ah, there we go. And of course, we're also joined by my co-host, professor of statistics and data science, Adi Weiner. So
that's,
Neil,
that's Grandpa Adi Weiner to you.
Oh, that's true. Congratulations, Grandpa. And I'm sure all of our listeners here, and if anybody wants to tweet a congratulations, of course, to Adi at W Moneyball, at W Moneyball, of course, you can always tweet at us there. The part I wanted to talk and start with you about today, Neil, there's lots of topics. I know you've done some recent work on the NBA. We want to get to that. I know you've done some work on the NHL. I definitely want to get to something about that. But I think we have to start with you with the college football playoffs. And I'll just start with maybe 10 or 15 seconds, and then I'd love to hear your take. When I saw the list come out of Michigan, Washington, Texas, and Alabama, I was a little surprised. But let me just say why, and then I'll give my 15 seconds, and then we'll turn it over to you, our guest. And then I know Shane wants to weigh in as well. I was trying to think, what objective function could the committee have been solving for? And I don't know the answer, but I've eliminated the following ones. They clearly didn't follow the Vegas betting odds, because these wouldn't be the four teams if you said, who would people bet on to win the championship? So that objective function is clearly not, and that data was available for the committee, so that wasn't it. We can eliminate team strength, which is obviously very correlated with the betting odds, because if you had built like an ELO model or a strength model or Massey Peabody, these weren't the four teams with the highest strength parameters. As a matter of fact, Shane had talked about it last week. Georgia would be in. I mean, if you built a model based on purely strength parameters, them losing one game by 3 points after winning 29 straight doesn't make them not a top four team.
Okay. Great thing about that objective function, you don't even have to play the season. You could do it beforehand.
Well, you could, but you could also play the season in who be two. You could even actually, what's interesting is, even if you look at the four teams they put in, conditional on those four, it's not done by strength. And so that wasn't the objective function. And so my question to you, and also I have to point out to our listeners, if Alabama, Shane, do you know what was the win probability of Auburn when they were up with a 4th and 29 on the last play of the game? If Alabama doesn't convert that, we're not even talking about Alabama being in the playoffs. So let's just put that in there too. But forget what I think. We have Neil Payne, expert, senior writer, editor and writer for The Messenger. What do you think the committee was doing?
Well, I mean, I think cynically what they were doing was finding a way to create sort of close, really like high powered talent matchups in the college football playoff semifinals and the final. And if that was their function, their goal for their function, then, you know, we're going to get a matchup of really good teams that also have huge fan bases. I think that was also part of it. But My problem with it is, if you're going to do that, just like be transparent about it and say that that's what you're trying to do. I think this idea of, you know, the best four teams, to your point, Eric, like Ohio State would be favored against probably everybody except Michigan in the whole country, probably. Oregon would be favored against Washington despite losing to them twice, I think. Like if you're talking – and Georgia, like you guys said, would probably be favored against maybe favored against Ohio State and maybe not favored against Michigan, but you could quibble with that, favored against everyone else. Even Penn State with two losses, you know, the predictive systems like them, and they might be up there if you're trying to think about the four best teams. So, you know, this talk of that and then leaving Florida State out after going undefeated in a Power Five conference, winning their conference championship on the basis of not having their number one quarterback or their number two quarterback at the end of the season. It just really speaks to this sort of ad hoc nature of the selection process. Everybody has kind of beaten this horse to death, but really, honestly, the fact that they could rank Florida State ahead of Georgia, which is like, who thinks that Florida State would be favored against Georgia? Their whole reason for leaving Florida State out of the Final Four was that they didn't think that they would be competitive against the other semifinalists. Yet also, you know, not put Georgia in the top four, not put Ohio State in the top four. It's this weird Frankenstein zombie mix of like, are you doing a prediction? Are you doing a retrodiction? And this is something that all of these things have always struggled with, like the NCAA type. You know, even the selection committee for March Madness, like, you know, do you put in a team that has really good predictive metrics that might include and probably should include point differential when that encourages running up the score? That's been something that they've struggled with for a long time. So this idea of like backwards looking versus forwards looking, and typically these types of committees have always sided on the direction of backwards looking accomplishment, you know, most deserving. That was the parlance that was used this past week. And I think that's the right thing to do, the right approach to take when you're talking about giving out, you know, something that is based on the body of work of a whole season. And what have you done? What have you accomplished? When you start getting into this idea of what might you do, who's the best on paper, you know, all of these ideas, who's the strongest team if we adjust for injuries and all the umpteen thousand different ways you can adjust, that is a really slippery slope that gets you into territory where, again, like, you could put in teams that have like two or three or, you know, however many more losses than undefeated teams if you really were talking about the strongest teams on paper in some seasons. You could put in like a 9-4 team over an undefeated team if that 9-4 team played a really tough schedule and ran up huge point differentials and the other team squeaked by. Do they really want to go down that path? I mean, that's really sort of, and I don't think they do. I think they made an exception in this particular case because of the circumstances and gave themselves permission to do a little, you know, bending of their own internal logic, and you end up with this thing that like has no internal consistency whatsoever. When you
just add one line before Shane jumps in with his thoughts here, I just don't think they were ever going to put a Final Four grouping in there without Alabama or Georgia in there, no matter what.
Well, that's it.
That's the constraint.
That gets to my point. They are incredibly consistent year to year. If you believe that this objective function, they're not transparent about it. The objective function is there must be their SEC team gets an automatic entry, and probably a Big Ten team gets an automatic entry. I mean, I don't think it's ever happened that hasn't been the case. And if you believe that the SEC gets an automatic entry, Alabama is the most deserving. They beat Georgia.
Yep.
You know, if you believe that Big Ten gets an automatic entry, Michigan is the obvious choice this year. And basically, you know, the rest can sort itself out, but you need to have for both, I think, I mean, this is probably the rationale for both quality of football, quality of the playoffs plus money. You need to have an SEC team in the Final Four, and you need to have a Big Ten team in the Final Four.
No, but there's and a logical, just one other thing to add before I jump to Adi. Just remember though, I agree with that sequential nature. I think they put Michigan 1 and Alabama in, but then you have to, in quotes, put Texas in, and that eliminates Florida State because Texas beat Alabama at Alabama. So the minute you go stage 1, SEC, Big 10, then Texas has to be in, and then Florida State's out.
when there's only really 2 degrees of freedom or two spots that are actually truly up for grabs, it really makes it a very difficult thing.
Let me ask you, pontificating pundits, why does Washington kind of automatically get in here? What's their undefeatedness, or why is the pack whatever sufficiently high enough to like outrank Florida State?
So Neil can talk about this. I think both the power rankings for the entire conference, their conferences play against other conferences. In Washington's case, they beat Oregon twice, and Oregon was considered one of the best 5 or 6 teams in the country, and they beat them twice. And the ACC, which Florida State won, didn't have any really, I mean, they had a few good wins against, let's call them good SEC teams, but there were no incredible wins by the ACC conference. But Neil, what's your thought about why Pac-12 over ACC this year?
No, I think you guys nailed it. And just Washington, you know, if you look at something like the Football Power Index at ESPN, Washington faced the 9th most difficult schedule and Florida State faced the 55th most difficult schedule. So there's definitely a difference there. And I agree with you guys that like once you make the determination that the SEC champion has to be in and the Big Ten champ, you know, if we're talking about the two super conferences, and then you have to use the head-to-head from that Bama-Texas game, you really run out of slots very quickly, which is why they're expanding the playoff, you know, that you wouldn't really have this problem in the future. But then you look at the whole scope of college football history, especially since the BCS era and into the playoff era, and you have another sort of ironclad or seemingly ironclad rule, which is if you have an undefeated power conference champion, they make the Final Four 100% of the time before this past season. So you do have these sort of competing rules or traditions or whatever you want to call it. And if you lock yourself in, I actually think you should lock yourself, if you're going to lock yourself into a rule, you should lock yourself into the undefeated rule for a power conference school, because I think that'll probably yield, you know, a team that is more in line with the traditions of a sport where it's really the only major sport where a team could go, the best teams do go undefeated at the end of the regular season. And that's sort of a big deal going back to when we were kids and you had like Nebraska going undefeated and, you know, so on and so forth, where a single loss during the regular season can and possibly should eliminate you from consideration. There's that baked in fear of losing these regular season games, whether it's in September. You know, Bama thought when they lost to Texas that was a huge you know, detriment to them, and certainly they played their way back into the conversation.
One solution to this, Neil, is I don't know why I just thought of this. Is, by the way, I want to thank Shane for the, you know, if you'd like, the two automatic spot theory, because I was trying to figure out what they're, and actually if you build that in, it's entirely logical why these are the four. But it almost reminds me of what we do in variable selection. What they should have done, according to me, is forward selection, backward selection, which means you put Michigan and Alabama in, okay? Then, of course, Washington has to go. Texas beat Bama. But now I do backward selection. Now Texas removes Alabama because Texas beat Alabama, and that leaves the spot open for Florida State. So I'm putting Alabama in, and then I'm removing them. See, I'm doing a forward selection, backward selection. I'm putting them in as the SEC champ. And then I know Shane's not buying this, but I'm putting them in as the SEC champ. And then Texas, I'm putting in over them because they beat them. And then that leaves Florida State, which Neil said is never happened in the history, and then that's why I'm putting them in as opposed to Alabama.
Or we kind of just pretend like Texas is already in the SEC, which, you know, happens next year, right? And that kind of that opens up our degree of another degree of freedom to let Florida State in.
Well, we're here on Wharton Moneyball. This is Eric Bradlow, Professor of Marketing and Statistics. I'm being joined by my two co-hosts, Shane Jensen and Adi Weiner, both professors of statistics here at the Wharton School. And we're joined by our host today, longtime friend, longtime co-host of the show, Neil Payne. Neil's a senior editor and writer for The Messenger. Adi, I saw your hand up. I know you wanted to jump in.
Yeah,
and then Shane.
I almost want to ask a non-statistical question, which is...
Is that allowed on this show?
Is that allowed? I mean, one that...
Well, I'm going to answer with a statistical answer.
I want to answer a question that doesn't really have a statistical answer, which is I always felt that we as analysts have overplayed our hand statistically by driving the metrics that predict well and measure kind of fundamental quality, and undervaluing what we call the resume, like actually winning when you needed to win. And we do that because we just don't find predictive value in it, which is an insight, of course. But nevertheless, the player that drives in the runs. I mean, I hate to bring it back to baseball, but I know that Neil doesn't mind. That, you know, you talk about the classic Williams versus DiMaggio MVP. The guy didn't, DiMaggio didn't deserve it by war. But DiMaggio had like 50% more RBIs. I mean, when the runs needed to be driven in, when the time needed to happen, you know, he just had high leverage batting average. And we would go, that's bullshit, doesn't predict, it's all random, garbage. But on the other hand, the guy does it when it needs to be. So when you talk about Florida State or the undefeated teams versus the one loss teams, personally, don't you feel like that should matter? Like actually doing it when you need it to get it
So, Neil,
done?
let me have you jump in here, but I just have to say facetiously for our listeners who are on Wharton Moneyball, that was Adi Wiener's non-statistical question, by the way. But please, but okay, Neil, why don't you jump in and answer this?
Well, this is exactly why I wanted to have this conversation with you guys, because I think all of us on some level or another have spent a lot of time in our careers thinking about this breakdown between what happened in the past, how much of that is noise, and how much of that you get quote unquote credit for going forward in a predictive sense. And in some ways, I think you're right, Adi. Like we're the ones that typically are saying, like, hey, Florida State, if you make, you know, if you look at their strength of schedule and you
Schedule.
look at their point differential and adjust for quarterback, you know, we've done this in NFL. I've done this, you know, for years with things going back to like the 2017 Eagles, which is actually kind of a fun counterexample of that. They don't make the, you know, hey, if there's a playoff committee, then they get left out of the playoffs, right? Because Nick Foles is not going to allow them to continue to be competitive in the playoffs, or even Trevor Lawrence this year. You know, you look at these quarterback injuries, but that's not how it works in other sports. But we have spent so much time thinking about like perfecting these forward-looking metrics that then now when they're actually being used for something that it almost feels like it's unfair to use them for, which is this assessment of like the body of a team's work looking backwards, it's like our own weapons are being used against us in some ways. It's a very weird feeling to be on the opposite side of that and arguing for Florida State, because I don't think Florida State would give much of a game if they were to have made it into, you know, even with the backup, not the, I mean, the third stringer, God forbid. But, you know, do I think that the committee should be playing that game and making these arbitrary adjustments for particular key injuries? I mean, we've seen a version of this, and I was reminded of this in the aftermath of the selection of like Cincinnati in basketball in 2000 was downgraded from a one seed to a two seed because Kenyon Martin was injured. And that was in my memory, that was like the first time I could think of like the selection committee for the March Madness making that type of
Wait,
determination.
Neil, I just
And
want to ask you a quick question, just
yeah.
for listeners here on Wharton Moneyball. Are you saying if Jordan Travis weren't injured, Florida State would have made it? And who would they have replaced in this four?
I think, I mean, it's
That's
tough
not
if you
obvious to
believe the
me.
SEC, if you believe the SEC requirement. There still would have been an argument, but I have to think, well, but okay, by taking the committee at their word, which of course, who knows what that's worth.
And then I want
It
Shane's answer
sounded
to this
like they would
question
put,
too, but go
yeah,
ahead.
it sounded like they would have put, they're trying to act like, and of course, it's easy to do this because Jordan Travis is hurt, but they tried to act like, oh, it's just such a shame that he's hurt because if he was healthy, we would have put them in, but he's not,
Instead of
so we
who?
can't.
Instead of
And probably
who?
instead of Bama. I mean, you think about it like the Texas over Bama, you know, head to head is sort of this like trump card that they can play to get Texas in. And then, you know, Michigan and Washington, just based on the resumes, I don't think they're going to drop an undefeated Washington out. So you end up with a situation of this numbers game where, like, taking them at their word again. It's sort of a hypothetical, but you know they try to act or portray like they would put Florida State in if Jordan Travis were healthy. Do we buy that? I don't know.
My answer is I do not take them at their word. I think they still would have excluded Florida State
It would have been
even with
harder,
that
though. It would
injury.
have been a
It would have
lot
been
harder.
an even harder argument, but they're fine. They're fine with, you know, they're not, you know, there's no such thing as bad attention, I think, as far as the college football playoff is concerned. As So, yeah, actually, my question for Neil or whoever wants to weigh in on this, because this is more of a projection thing into the future. Thankfully, we're getting an expanded playoff next year, right?
Yep.
Will it matter in the sense that our, you know, I mean, by having this four, you know, we're kind of also implicitly saying that, like, you know, if if we had sort of like a quarterfinals and an expanded roster, how often would it be that, you know, one of these actual teams makes it through? Like Florida State goes on a run.
Yeah,
the committee is basically saying that there's no chance, you know, when we expand that Florida State would have gone through anyway.
Well, let me ask you guys in a very pointed question, but I have a specific answer, but I want to ask Neil this question. So Neil, let's imagine I give you Michigan, Washington, Texas, and Alabama, the four from this year. And here's the other eight teams I'm going to give you. You can have Georgia. You can have Penn State. You can have Oregon. You can have Florida State. I'll give you whatever other four teams you want also. Which group do you think has higher total probability? The four? This is Shane's question. I'm just asking you. The four or the eight?
I mean, given the fact that Georgia and Ohio State could potentially be in that eight.
And Oregon?
I think I'm taking the eight just from a pure, like, if you look at a ranking, like an unpredictable style, like, and I know he doesn't do this for college football anymore, but this is the guy, Mike Bowie, that does the looks at the betting lines for each game and then derives the implied ratings of every team out of those. I think if you did that for college football, those teams would be, you know, maybe like numbers, you know, three of the top four or something if you looked at a predictive rating. So I'm taking the eight in that, which is it's basically, could I build a more predictive Final Four than the committee, which then pokes a hole in that argument that they're picking the four best teams. Like, it's such a weird, like, they
didn't, I eliminated the that best immediately as an option. There's no way they were picking that.
They didn't
there's
pick the no four way, best, I, and they didn't
asking,
pick the
I'm
four
just asking, yeah, I'm just answering deserving. The question that was asked. I think I'd take the eight also.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Let me rephrase my question a little bit. Obviously, we've already come to agree that you can get competitive games, you know, with more than four teams, top six. Dropping it down to 12, how many competitive, you know, because you are going to, once you get down to 12 or so, how many competitive games are we going to sort of see? We're already kind of complaining a little bit with the NFL and its expanded wild card weekend, you know, it's wild card weekend that we're letting in a lot of teams where all of a sudden these games are not starting. You know, you're getting a lot of blowouts in the first round of the playoffs.
All right. So
are we going to see that again?
Let's say
college football expands.
Yeah. Let's ignore Liberty for a second, because I think Liberty might have made the top 12 potentially in the, but let's say right now, 9, 10, 11, and 12 were Missouri, Penn State, Ole Miss, and Oklahoma. I'll go with, look, Adi, you tell me this. Let's even imagine, you did this calculation a couple weeks ago, Adi. Let's imagine each of those teams. Let's pretend each of those teams against Florida State, Georgia, Ohio State, and Oregon were each 14-point underdogs. What's the probability that one 14-point underdog gets through? It's not that small, right?
Nope. About one. In six games, right? Or
in four games. I'm saying if five through eight games. Paid 9 through 12.
Okay.
Shane's question is, would any of those games be competitive?
No, actually, I'm asking about the winners of those games.
Oh.
Like the quarterfinals, would they be competitive? Because then you have one versus whoever.
I get Georgia, Ohio State, and Oregon.
Assuming they make it through, yeah.
If they make it
through. The problem with this is that, here's my question. You know, Michigan and Ohio are about the same.
Yep.
And Alabama and Georgia are about the same. Washington and Oregon are about the same. They basically had columns, and they just had two in each one that were basically identical, and they had a formula to pick.
That's it.
And Texas, I don't know where they fit in compared to the rest of the group, but it probably drops down pretty fast.
Texas lost to Oklahoma, by the way, but go ahead.
Right. They lost to Oklahoma. It probably drops down pretty fast. So the basic issue is the top six here are probably responsible for 95% of the probability. Is that what you'd say is fair, Neil?
That's kind of the point I'm trying to make is you don't think so?
No, because, I'm just going by the college football playoff rankings. 7 and 8 are Ohio State and Oregon. They have more than a 5% probability in this particular year. So it's probably, remember, you have to put Florida State and Georgia 5 and 6. But Neil, what are your thoughts?
It seems this year to go 8 deep if you're talking about teams that are sort of considered on a different level than everyone else. And you could quibble about Penn State because I think their underlying stats are better than their actual record, but they have two losses, so whatever. But, you know, I think the bigger point is that I don't think we're going to have these battles over the cutoff line between number 12 and number 13 in future years or whatever, the same way we're having the cutoff about 5 versus 4. And that's a good thing. You know, this may be the last great debate that we have about, you know, who gets excluded versus who gets to play it on the field. Now, there will be, because it's a 12 team bracket, you know, particularly, there will be a lot of intense debate over, you know, who gets that, who gets a bye and what the seedings are and all those different things. And we can look forward to those. But at least you'll get to prove it on the field. And, you know, I think that's the big thing for Florida State is like, it's a weird thing to argue for because, like, we admitted earlier in the segment that we didn't think Florida State would be able to prove it on the field, just that they deserved it based on their backwards looking numbers. But hey, they're not the same team to in a month that they are today as well. So this idea of like, well, they're not the same team that they were, you know, a month ago or whatever. I have just a fundamental problem with a shady cabal of a bunch of, you know, college sports administrators sitting in a room and making these ad hoc adjustments for, you know, things like quarterback injuries that like, okay, well, tell me, like in past years, if, you know, Alabama, like Tua goes down, you know, in the SEC championship or whatever, are you making, now granted they had Jalen Hurts as the backup or whatever, but are you, you know, if it's an SEC team that loses its quarterback, are you making the same adjustment? Probably not. And that's why I think a lot of people just felt like, and so to me, one thing, last thing that I want to bring up is what does this do for the nature of trying to kind of do a college football playoff predictor? Because that's something that we did at 538 for many years, and we did it based on, you know, a set of rules. And this gets back to what you're talking about at the top of the segment, Eric, where, you know, anytime you're doing a prediction like that, it has to be based on some systematic, you know, set of rules that will rank a team and adjustments you can make, but adjustments that are made to everyone. You know, it has to be fair and it has to kind of, you know, be applied globally. But I wonder if this just sort of like ultimately the committee being able to do whatever it wants is something that you can't possibly model for. Like we didn't do one this year because, you know, RIP 538 Sports, but ESPN had their playoff predictor and it gave Florida State a 97% chance of making the playoff. And, you know, maybe the solution is just when in doubt, add more uncertainty. I think that's probably something that we've talked about a lot over the years as well. When you're in one of these situations, past precedent can always be upended by your shady cabal. But I think also in some ways it calls into question even the mere exercise of trying to do a playoff predictor when it comes down to, like, you can fight the last war, right? You can put in, you can be like, well, in the future, we're going to do a quarterback injury adjustment. And that'll help us in these particular cases. And it's like the committee's going to find some kind of arbitrary edge case, unless you do just some crazy, like, if conference equals SEC, add 100 ELO points or something. I'm not even joking, though. Like, that might be appropriate, like, in your back testing. But, you know, I'm curious what you guys think about the endeavor of – it's fundamentally different than trying to do a playoff predictor for other sports because they have rules that they must follow. It's not like, you know, we made the Trevor Lawrence joke, but it's not like since Jacksonville's, you know, starting quarterback is injured that they're going to potentially not win the AFC – you know, or, like, the NFL powers that be will decide, Roger Goodell will decide that the Jaguars can't make the playoffs after week 18. That's not how it works. There are rules that must be followed, but this college football is a sport where there are no, it's like, whose line is it anyway? There are no rules and the points don't matter.
Well, let me just say a couple things. And then I want to hear your take on the NBA. Just a couple quick things. I think next year, at least for the top, Shane reminded us last week, I think top 4 or 5 spots out of 12, there is a rule. And so the conference champions of the major conferences are those top spots, and they're the ones that get the buys. And so that at least they're trying that to start. That might change when, you know, I'll make it up, a 9-4 team wins the whatever, the ACC or whatever, and ends up in one of the top 3 spots, and an 11-1 Ohio State ends up at number 6 playing an extra game or something like that. But at least they're trying to have some rules.
They got to fix up how conferences work. Like, how is Michigan versus Iowa? That was the conference championship.
Yes.
They got to fix that. They got to fix that, too. I mean, come on. It's Ohio State versus Michigan.
That was the championship game anyway.
But
I wanted to ask Neil two other just quick things. And literally 15 seconds on each, because I want to save whatever time we have left, Neil, for you to talk about the work you're doing with the NBA. since I everybody knows I'm Mr. Chaos when it comes for college football, can I dream that Florida State beats Georgia? And then, in my view, they claim a split national championship. They can claim whatever they want. They're not the national champion. But if Florida State were to beat Georgia, it's hard to argue that a 14-0 Florida State that just beat Georgia with their at least their backup quarterback, Rodemaker or whatever, will be back. And can I also dream that Liberty will beat Oregon and that all of a sudden they'll be undefeated too? And by the way, I only want those two things to happen if Texas or Alabama wins, because then we'll have a national championship with one loss and Liberty and Florida State will have zero losses. That's what I want. Do I have any chance of my dream?
Well, I just want to note that so the coaches poll is obligated to rank the college football playoff winner number one, but the AP poll is not under that obligation. So, you know, supposedly in the playoff era, we're not supposed to have split national championships anymore, and it won't happen just because it won't. But you can dream that because there is no obligation for the AP poll to, and if you somehow could organize, like it'd be fun to organize some kind of protest vote in the AP poll of like put Florida State at number one just to mess with, like I think, what was it, Central Florida, they didn't win the AP poll, but there was some obscure rating system that ranked them number one a few years ago.
Yeah, that was undefeated. That was the at E Bradlow Twitter poll. I was the one that said they should have been ranked number one that year. And I talked about it for about three straight years on Wharton Moneyball.
Oh yeah. So, but they put up a friggin' banner. You know, they had like, they may have had like championship rings. So yes. Maybe they could get some, you know, maybe Florida State out of pure spite and, you know, just as a middle finger to the committee, they could find some kind of ranking that would officially, quote unquote, vote them number one and claim a championship. I think that's possible.
All right. Well, Neil, let's just switch to the last like 4 or 5 minutes that we have. I know you're doing a ton of work on the NBA right now. It's kind of getting second shrift at the moment just because it's always, you know, NFL always gets top dog when it's around. College football's obviously been a very interesting season. From your mind, what's going on in the NBA? I mean, obviously the Celtics look very good. The Nuggets, forget that they don't have the best record at the moment in the West. They look good. But like, what's surprising you? What are you looking at in the NBA right now?
Well, right now, I mean, the biggest thing going on is the in-season tournament. We had some great games last night. We're going to have more in which the Celtics actually got knocked out, which was a little bit of a surprise. Although the Pacers are a really fun, interesting, and all offense, no defense team. To me, that's sort of the big thing right now. And just seeing the kind of quasi playoff atmosphere, especially once you get into this like knockout round where like every game is a game seven, basically. But the, you know, it's not a real championship. And I wrote a story about the Knicks because, you know, this is sort of their they're in the in-season tournament. They could win it. If they did win, I think it would be kind of funny because nobody would really know how to process that. They'd be like, you know, if it's a team like the Bucks that win, then I think people would be like, oh yeah, that checks out. This is totally a legit championship. And then if like the Knicks win or something like that, they would be like, wait, does this devalue the in-season tournament or are they going to hang a banner? Speaking of UCF, you know, for winning the in-season tournament.
I grew up a Knicks fan and we haven't put up a banner since 1973.
I know, that's what I'm
saying. We're putting up a banner.
If any franchise had sort of the motivation and the excuse to do it, it would be the Knicks. You know, do you have a parade through the Canyon of Heroes if you win the in-season tournament? But, you know, I still think it's fun, though, like as much as we're kind of ragging on it a little bit. The players have really bought in, probably $500,000 for each of them, you know, sweetens that attitude a little bit. But I think it's also been fun. I think they should change the courts next year. Those are kind of a hideous eyesore. But aside from that, I think it's been a great idea. I'm curious what other sports are going to adopt it because I think it's fantastic to make this early part of this NBA regular season, which traditionally has seen a lot, just total like apathy among fans, players, media, you know, everything, because the NBA regular season is just way too long at 82 games. It has infused the first couple months of the regular season with this sense of meaning and purpose, which I think is actually really just what the NBA needed. And you can kind of sustain that into Christmas. Those games are always really big, national stage, even if they're sharing it with the NFL now. And then the All-Star, like they've really figured out this bridge to the other parts of the regular season that people are interested in. And then sooner than you know, it's going to be the playoffs, which is what everybody really kind of lives for. So
I hadn't even thought about your comment, which I think a great one about the timing of this. Like, why not make it later in the season? Well, you already got excitement later in the season. The NFL's done. The college football's done. They got the spotlight later in the season. They want to grab some now. It makes a lot of sense. But Shane, you had a comment here as well.
Well, I just pursuant to that, I think they have to do it earlier season too, because as I understand, these count as regular season games.
They do,
right?
They absolutely
well,
the only
so
one
that you have to do it early because you have to be able to rebalance things after, right? Because
absolutely.
You know, if you have a couple teams matching, you know, you know, if the Knicks go up against the Bucks in the semifinals, that's one game that they can't play.
Just
later
to be
on.
Clear, though, Shane, all the games up until now were regularly scheduled regular season games.
Yeah, so but now that we're in these knockout round, that would have to be rebalanced
correct.
Later in the season, correct?
Well, and not only that, but the teams that got eliminated from the in the group stage, there were 22 additional games that were added to the regular season schedule involving those teams, which will be played, I think, over the next like week or two as well. And then there's another game to be added to the schedule that will two games that will contain all of the teams that get eliminated in the quarterfinals of the in-season tournament. So they're actually adding games, which I know because I'll throw in a quick little plug here. I have a prediction model at The Messenger that people can find if you go to themessenger.com/sports that, you know, I simulate out the season a bunch of times using power ratings and I had to add 22 additional games. Well, technically 24 based on, you know, the ones that are conditional on who loses this next round. So I was intimately acquainted with that. And that's all just to get everybody to 82 games like normal. And then technically the two finalists will play an 83rd game that will not count toward the regular season, nor will it count toward the playoffs. So it'll be like those play-in games that the stats are lost in limbo. Like, you know, a couple of years ago, I think it was Devin Booker had like some crazy number of points in one of those games that like don't count toward his career record. So that's always not sat great with me as a stat fiend and stat collector, but at the same time, I understand why they want every team to have the same number of games.
Well, Neil, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Wharton Moneyball. We'd like to thank you for your insight on college football. We'd like to thank you for the work you're doing also with the NBA. And of course, everyone can find Neil Payne. He's a senior editor and writer for The Messenger. Neil, thank you for joining us here on Wharton Moneyball.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
So that's been our full hour of show. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Adi Weiner and Shane Jensen. I'm Eric Bradlow. Some combination of the three of us and Cade Massey are here every week on Wharton Moneyball. I'd like to thank our producer, boss man, Matt Datz. I'd like to thank our associate producer and sound engineer, Dion Simpkins. Between now and next week, enjoy your sports, and we'll see you next week here on Wharton Moneyball.